We're going to be talking about sugar, salt, fats, as in polyunsaturated and saturated fats, proteins, and food additives. And each of us are going to talk about 5 minutes or something like that, and then we'll leave the rest of the time for questions and discussion. I guess I'm trying to say that we are by no means experts on it, but we'll try and do what we can.
Okay. I'm going to start out talking about sugar. And you probably heard a lot about the evils of sugar, but this is just to help you get some facts behind some of the things you've heard. There are five types of sugar. There's fructose, which is a fruit sugar, lactose, milk sugar, maltose, which is a malt sugar, glucose, which is blood sugar, and sucrose, which is refined sugar. And that's the bad one. We have far more than, we have a lot more sucrose, or we take in a lot more sucrose than any other kind of sugar. And sucrose is found in table sugar, honey, brown sugar, which is really just caramelized or burnt sugar added to refined sugar, molasses, and corn syrup. We consume on the average about 130 pounds of sugar a year. That's each of us. That adds up to about a pound of sugar every 3 days. If you don't eat cake...
Is that true?
Oh, yeah.
You're sugared.
I found that everywhere I've read, that's what it said.
There is.
Yes.
Even if you don't eat cakes, cookies, ice cream, candy, etc., you take in a lot of sucrose because it's in ketchup, mustard, peanut butter, baked beans, breads, bouillon cubes, dinner rolls, bologna, pastrami, chili, canned soups, frozen vegetables, flavored yogurts, natural cereals, baby food, all kinds of stuff. You can't avoid it. Okay. Since sugar has become popular in this country, the food industry has caught on to this, and they add a lot of sugar. As I mentioned before, to things like breads, things that you don't think taste sweet. I had a friend who went to Norway and lived there for a while, and when he came back, one thing he did comment on was how sweet things tasted here, things that he'd never noticed before. And I think that has a lot to do with, you know, commercial foods. Sugar consumption accounts for about 1/5 of our total calorie intake, and these calories are totally useless. They're empty. To make things worse, when we consume sugar, we not only take in no nutrients, but we use nutrients that we get from other food sources to digest the sugar. And involved in this is vitamin B, which we need to burn up protein and to utilize glucogen for glucose to provide energy for muscle tissues. So we lose a lot of vitamin B when you eat a lot of sugar. A survey conducted in 1970 showed that almost 2/3 of the commercials aimed at young television viewers emphasized heavily sugared foods or pre-sweetened breakfast cereals. Some, such as King Vitamin, Sugar Smacks, and Super Orange Crisp, ranged from 58 to 68% refined sugar. Sugar intake on an excessive level is also connected with our number one killer, heart disease. Several experiments have proved the effect of sugar on triglyceride levels. And triglycerides are fatty elements in the bloodstream, and they contribute, or are one of the factors that contribute to the occurrence of heart attacks. Sugar has also been found to increase the body's fluid retention, which has a direct impact on elevated blood pressure. Diabetes is another disease closely associated with excessive sugar. And 5 to 12 million Americans are diabetics, and millions more are potential diabetics. 1,000 new cases are reported every day. It's been predicted that at this rate, in 1980, 1 out of 5 people in the United States will have diabetes. Some experts believe that this is the second-ranked killer because it also accelerates other potentially fatal conditions, such as arterial sclerosis, stroke, heart attack, and kidney failure. Diabetes is the leading cause of new blindness in the U.S. and England, two of the world's leading sugar-consuming countries. Another thing I ran across was well, for me, I've always thought of, you know, cavities as a part of life, you know. You eat and your teeth are going to decay. But I read in, I think it was, well, it was in this book, Sugar Blues, which is a real biased book. It's not one that, you know, I'd base everything on. But he does have a few facts in here that I think you can trust. A lot of the other stuff, he doesn't really mention his sources, so I don't know. I'll just read it, keeping that in mind. But anyway, he did mention the fact that there are primitive tribes who, where dental disease is completely unknown, because they don't take in things, refined things like sugar and flour, and they eat a lot of natural carbohydrates. Which carbohydrates? Sugar raises the blood sugar level temporarily, only to let it fall rapidly a short time later. Half an hour after consuming sugar, it is used up, and one is left with the familiar symptoms of hypoglycemia, low blood sugar. This is there headache, dizziness, fatigue, and irritability. The common reaction is to reach for something sweet and repeat the process. When we eat an excessive amount of sugar, we overstimulate the pancreas, producing an excess of insulin. A person may develop an addiction to sweets to satisfy this insulin secretion, or the blood sugar level may drop dangerously low, resulting in hypoglycemia, which is the exact opposite of diabetes, but it often occurs before diabetes. When the pancreas becomes exhausted by the constant demand of producing insulin, it may finally malfunction, and then the excess sugar will contaminate the bloodstream, and this results in diabetes. And then I have some stuff I've already talked about tooth decay and how that's primarily a result of overconsumption of sugar. And that's about it. I guess for myself, sugar is something that's very, very hard to kick, very hard to not to want. But it's something that is present in our food from birth, you know, present in baby food. So I think we develop a taste for it, and we can unlearn this taste for it as well. So there'll be questions at the end of the whole presentation if you want to ask anything about it.
I was going to go from there right into just say a few words about coffee, and that coffee and sugar are two substances often that are consumed at the same time, or we've developed a taste to have coffee with cake or something like that. This is what specifically came out of the community meeting and the concern for the coffee consumption. And I found a couple things. I'm not going to say much because it's hard to find anything that's not biased. But in the cookbook, Laura's Kitchen, they have a nutrient analysis of all different kinds of food. And they had one of coffee, which I thought was kind of interesting. And that's what I had written up on the board. And my handwriting is kind of light, but in one average cup of coffee, there's 0.5 milligrams of niacin, 0.2 milligrams of iron, 4 milligrams of calcium, 2 milligrams of sodium, 7 milligrams of phosphorus, and 65 milligrams of potassium. Now, this is a substance that I thought had nothing in it all of my life. You know, I just thought it was absolutely empty. So, of that 65 milligrams of potassium, one substance that I know to compare it with is if you're on a diet where you need to have potassium, they always tell you to eat bananas. Bananas are a really good source. One small banana has about 350 milligrams of potassium, so that kind of puts it in perspective. It's not a bad source. I guess one thing that surprised me the most was the sodium, which is just a fancy name for salt. If you're on a kind of a diet that is restricting of salt, that means you shouldn't have coffee. It's something that doesn't really taste salty.
Can I make a comment there?
Sure.
It's funny if some of you have gone on diets or different kind of diets, that they always tell you that you can have a cup of coffee or, you know, some cold beverage or something that maybe isn't really good for you, but yet it's okay for you to have that.
Yeah, it's not really very much sodium, but it is a little bit. And then on the other side of the board, I put down about caffeine and how much caffeine is in coffee. Depending on, I guess, whether you have vacuum-packed, drip, percolated, there is around 100 to 150 milligrams of caffeine in 1 6-ounce cup of coffee. Instant, there's somewhere around 80 to 100. Decaffeinated, 1 to 6 milligrams. And then if you compare that with tea, depending on different kinds, they didn't say which kinds, 43 to 110 milligrams. So it is less, but that's there is a good bit. And then in 12 ounces of a cola drink, there's like 35 to 45. So there's a lot less caffeine in Coke or something like that.
Herbal teas do not have caffeine.
That's right.
I also want to make a comment about tea. Something I remember from my days studying pharmacology was caffeine is the weakest member under the group of drugs called xanthines. And tea also has a greater degree of the next most powerful drug in that family. And I can't remember its name, but it starts with a TH. So it is deceptive. Tea has both caffeine and this other drug, and it is actually got more central nervous system stimulant than coffee does.
Some of the properties of caffeine that most of us already know are it has a diuretic action, it makes you go to the bathroom a lot. It makes your heart beat faster and it forces more blood through the veins that goes along with that. There is an ability of coffee to relieve headache, which I didn't know that before, and that happens because of it makes the blood vessels in your brain smaller. It is capable of stimulating all parts of your central nervous system.
Smaller?
Mm-hmm.
Why would a vasoconstrictor cause your headache to go away?
I don't really understand that.
I think I read once where it could go on coffee with severe headaches.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That is a thing. And it
looks like an addiction.
It's also, well, caffeine is used sometimes to relieve a headache after a spinal headache. Ability to relieve headache is thought to be due to mild cerebral vasoconstriction action and possibly to increased vascular tone. So they don't really know why, you know, but that's their hypothesis. And then caffeine as a drug is often used, or is used orally, as an aid to help stay awake and to restore mental alertness. Kind of compared with the dose, with the milligrams that I have on the board, like in one regular cup of coffee, there's 100 to 150 milligrams of caffeine. A dose of caffeine in a pill, if you were to be taken, it would be somewhere from 65 to 250 milligrams in a day. But 250 milligrams would be the most you would take for a medical purpose. So if you have 2 cups of coffee, if it's at the maximum amount, you've exceeded what you would be given for a medical purpose of the caffeine. Other people might have something they'd like to add about coffee. That's just presented strictly from mostly what I got from this book that talks about drugs and nursing implications. It's real hard to find something that says that coffee is, well, you can find stuff that says coffee is really bad for you, but it's not documented well. You can find stuff that says coffee is good for you, you know, and that's not documented very well. Does anyone else know anything?
There was an article in Time recently on coffee causing cancer in animals. Caffeine or something, and they said a woman would have to drink 20 cups of coffee a day or something. Or it was something to do with pregnancy.
They do recommend that pregnant women not drink coffee.
But it would have to be an awful lot of coffee.
Yeah.
But one of the doctors at home did not recommend and very firmly said that decaffeinated coffee was much more dangerous than regular coffee, even though it doesn't contain the caffeine. That in the process of taking the caffeine out of the coffee, there is a poison formed. And that poison is much more dangerous than the caffeine itself. And he said that anyone who was trying to kick the coffee habit should not go to decaffeinated coffee. Now, what his basis were, what his facts were, I don't know, but he very flatly made that statement.
Wait till you were finished and you feel that way.
Yeah, a little bit.
Okay, I have salt. How many of you salt your food when you get to the table before you even taste it? At least we have two honest ones. Three.
You're more than those two.
Could be scallions on the open.
Really not many too.
Yeah, that is really good. I mean, if that is honestly how many do that, because I know I see a lot more people when we get to the table that do salt their food before they even taste it. So, table salt, sodium chloride. It's both of these elements are essential for our bodies, and salt alone can be one of the best flavor enhancers that we've known. But, a teaspoon of salt usually contains approximately 2 grams of sodium and 3 grams of chloride, which equals 5 grams. This is 5 times more than the amount of sodium than a normal person would need in a day. And the average American usually eats 2 to 3 teaspoons of salt per day, which is 10 to 15 grams of salt. Intake is really something that we should be made aware of. And according to Lois Blinkhorn, in a hard look at food ads, this has been an article in the newspaper, 60% of sodium is already in packaged foods before people exercise the choice of whether or not to salt it. The average adult consumes 15 pounds of salt per year just as an additive in processed foods. Now I know, like at Holden here, most of our cooking is done from scratch, and one of the reasons why is to try to prevent this added salt that we get in foods that we buy. And just by buying them and eating them, you're already getting 60% usually of salt in the food. And then usually
60% of what?
Of sodium.
Of what you need?
Of what you need each day. It's not 60% of the total mass of prepared food. So it's 60% of what?
Well, as an additive. I don't know how to, as an additive seasoning to either as a preservative or as a flavor enhancer. Usually 60% of that is salt, and it's already been added to the food, to the processed food.
Might have meant that 60% of our intake comes from...
60% of our intake of salt?
Of salt comes from commercially prepared foods?
I don't think that's what I interpreted to be.
Okay.
I know that...
Well, there's a lot of salt in commercially prepared foods.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
That possibly could be. That the quote wasn't explained.
Uh-huh.
So that's how I understood it, so maybe
I know, that's just the way it was with sugar. They said 80% of our intake of sugar comes from commercially prepared food.
Okay. So I just kind of, I was thinking of all the different things that I eat that have salt in them already, and I thought, well, a really good way of cutting down on salt is to cut down on these processed foods. And a lot of them are convenience foods, and which we don't usually eat so much here, but at home, I'm sure we do. And these are can include condiments, salty snacks like pretzels, popcorn, peanuts.
Fritos.
Sauces, pickled foods, sandwich meats. Sandwich meats have a real high sodium content. And then there's also salt found in foods that are kind of unsuspecting, like baking soda, MSG, which is monosodium glutamate. It's used as a seasoning in a lot of soups. Baking powder, and Marty mentioned coffee. And even in medications, there's salt found in antacids. So,
Twinkies
why be concerned
too.
About this? What?
Twinkies, too.
Twinkies.
Sure,
yeah. Yeah, sure so, because there's like a bready consistency around it. So why be concerned about all of this salt talk? Excessive salt intake is involved in many serious diseases, including heart disease, obesity, high blood pressure. And of course, not everybody has the same susceptibility to having high blood pressure. But it is something that we really should be aware of, because a lot of the time, people can be asymptomatic to high blood pressure for many years before the symptoms occur, and then usually it's kind of late, and then you have to go on some kind of a drug therapy to control it. So it is something that we should be aware of, even though you might not have high blood pressure now. Hypertension or high blood pressure is really a prevalent disease in the United States. In fact, 1 out of 6 Americans right now have high blood pressure. Not that that was kind of, I didn't realize that it was 1 out of 6. That's pretty high. Okay. Although they think that high blood pressure most likely is due to a combination of factors, salt really has shown to be one of the most contributing reasons for it. And I just wanted to read a paragraph. This is the American Journal of Nursing, and the article I'm reading from is called Hypertension: What Does It Mean to the Body? A high dietary sodium intake has been implicated as one of the major causes of high blood pressure. Salt may directly raise the blood pressure by increasing peripheral resistance in a number of ways. Several theories have been considered. First, the arteries of hypertensives are thought to contain more sodium, making them more sensitive to agents such as norepinephrine, which is the opposite of adrenaline. It's like this noradrenaline, a hormone that causes you to relapse. Second, the sodium-calcium exchanges across the membrane of arterial smooth cells, muscle cells, may change, allowing higher levels of ionized calcium within the cells. This increased ionized calcium heightens the smooth muscle contraction and thus increases peripheral resistance. Now, what all that means, basically, is that you have a balance of sodium and calcium in your bloodstream. And because of a higher salt intake, it causes the ions to build up. To make it easy, anyway, what it causes is that your blood vessels have to constrict, which means it makes more of a resistance for your blood to flow through your vessels. In populations with low sodium intakes, high blood pressure is rare. In contrast, in populations with high sodium intake, blood pressure is very common. If people with high blood pressure severely restrict their sodium intake, their blood pressure will usually fall, although almost always it doesn't always go down to a normal level. In a study done by Dr. James Hunt of the Mayo Clinic, he and his co-workers studied over 700 hypertensive patients who failed to respond to the drug therapy treatment. The group was placed on a weight-reducing diet and total salt intake was limited. While many doctors insist drug therapy is essential to control hypertension, Dr. Hunt notes that half of his patients on nutritional therapy alone brought their blood pressure under control. So what are the practical ways that we can limit our salt intake? Well, I have 5 here that, you know, I don't know how hard it would be for you to do, but I thought I'd listen because they were the ones mentioned in almost all the material I read. The first one, of course, is to take the salt shaker off the table. and not even use it. The second is to limit your salt in your cooking, and they suggest using herbs like onions and chives and garlic, lemon and lime, instead of the usual salting. Another way is to read food labels carefully. Try to determine the amounts of sodium in the processed foods and snack items. And of course, probably one of the hardest and of all is to try to learn to enjoy the flavor of unsalted foods.
I'm going to talk a little bit about fats in our diet. And when people think of fats, they immediately think of things like cholesterol and get bad connotations. But at the same time, fat is a necessary constituent in your diet. Things that it does, it provides and facilitates the metabolism of the fat-soluble vitamins, which are vitamin A, D, E, and K. And fats also contain the required linoleic acid, which is a big source of energy for your body. It also provides the bulk or the feeling of fullness and flavor to meals. Fat supplies the essential fatty acids your body needs, and it offers calories in compact form, which is good and bad. It's approximately 9 calories per gram of fat. Fats also travel in the bloodstream, which is what enables the fat-soluble vitamins to be metabolized. But too much calorie-rich fat will cause obesity and decrease the nutritional intake of other required things. So, let's look a little bit at fats. What are fats? Fats are made of various kinds of fatty acids. For example, butter is made up of 29 kinds of fatty acids. And the distribution of these fatty acids is what determines whether the fat melts at a certain temperature or not. What are fatty acids, you ask? Fats are real complicated chemically, and so I'm trying to simplify this as much down for people who have not had organic chemistry. Fatty acids are, in essence, an atom, a carbon chain atom, and at the end of the carbon chain is the acid attached on a tail, and off the carbon molecules, the carbon atoms themselves on the molecule, they're like little arms extended. Okay, and that's what determines whether they're saturated or unsaturated. Whether they're monounsaturated or polyunsaturated, or totally saturated. What is a saturated fatty acid? The saturated fatty acids have hydrogens attached to all the little arms on the carbons. And their chief component then are found in animal fats, butters, and dairy products. They don't melt at room temperature, and they increase the blood cholesterol level. Unsaturated fats, on the other hand, or monounsaturated fats, have two arms of the carbon chain open, and those arms join in a bond together, and so there are no hydrogens attached there. And they neither increase or decrease the blood cholesterol level. Polyunsaturated fats, on the other hand, are two or more pairs of arms without the hydrogens attached, and there's a double bond between those carbons also. And they are liquid at room temperature. They decrease your blood cholesterol level when consumed. And kinds of fats that will be included in this group are corn oil, vegetable oil, soybean oil, cottonseed oil, and safflower oil.
What's that group name?
Polyunsaturated.
Those are the good ones.
Those are the good ones, yes, because they decrease the blood cholesterol. So now we can look at what cholesterol is. It's not a fatty acid, and it's more of a complicated substance that's more like a wax than fat. The body requires cholesterol, and it's used for adrenal and sex hormone production, and it's also used in utilization of vitamin D. Your body needs it to use vitamin D. But the body itself manufactures cholesterol in its required amount every day, which is 200 to 800 milligrams per person. Regardless of the amount of your daily intake. But an increased daily intake in your diet will decrease, it depresses the synthesis of this cholesterol, but it doesn't depress the synthesis enough to compensate for the side effects of, it won't cancel out the effects of the excess intake. A high saturated fat diet will increase your blood cholesterol level to a great degree, and also sugar and a high carbohydrate intake also stimulates cholesterol production. And also an intake of cholesterol itself, like egg yolks are really high in cholesterol. When the blood has had too much cholesterol, the cholesterol will settle into the vessel walls and begins to coat the walls, which decreases the elasticity of your arteries and veins, which is the start of atherosclerosis, which is a big problem in our country with our diets. And as these deposits continue, besides losing elasticity, and so your blood flow is not being pushed along, like your arteries don't pump the way they should. The vessels get narrower, and less blood gets to the places they need to go. And it can eventually become occluded with the fat deposits, or blood will start, platelets will collect on that and cause a thrombosis, which is a blood clot in your vessel. And if this happens, like in a major artery in your brain or in the heart itself, it will cause a coronary attack or a stroke. I thought I'd look too at hydrogenated fats, which are.
Before you go on, I have a question. How can you get rid of cholesterol once it's in your system? Or excess cholesterol?
Excess?
Is there a way to scrub those vessel walls?
Once it's there, it's there.
Would the polyunsaturated take help that situation? You said that somehow
it'll decrease your daily level.
Well, it'll decrease your daily level, but the cholesterol is already in your system.
Yeah, if there's deposits on your vessels.
I heard last week about a new drug that flushes you out. Yeah, that's right. No, that's right. I heard about it. I'm trying to talk about that. And it goes in there and it sort of loosens up all the platelets on the junk. And
I think
sounds
you have
like
to,
heparin.
Yeah, that's pretty dangerous. That's, you know, have all that stuff floating around in your blood vessels. Might be worse than having it attached to the walls.
Yeah.
Well, it flushes it out. Gets rid of it. Maybe it's not so big. It
goes right to your heart.
It's a closed system. How would it flush it out?
I don't know. That makes sense.
If it reaches. To me, it almost sounds
like heparin?
Which is a drug that decreases your clotting time. And so it would dissolve the clots in the blood.
What is lecithin?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm stuck.
I've heard about this before. My mother always takes the some pills. It's an ingredient in egg whites that where it's good old Mother Nature has a natural balance between lecithin helps dissolve it, but I think once you get it in your arteries, it's hard to get rid of it. If you take lecithin, it helps to keep it from forming, but I think once, you know, if you're 50,
so
you've been eating
the best. So the cholesterol, it takes care of the cholesterol that you're eating, but not the stuff that's already in you.
Yeah.
Where does exercise fit in all this? Doesn't that make a difference with cholesterol and the
weight? Exercise is going to give your blood vessels better tone, but it's not really going to, if I'm correct on this, it's not going to use up the cholesterol that your body eats.
That's right. Because your body can only utilize what it needs at that time.
And your body is also capable of making cholesterol. So if you're not eating enough cholesterol, your body's going to make it.
What is it used for in the body?
It's used for utilization of vitamin D and also the production of adrenal hormones and sex hormones.
Does the kitchen cook with polyunsaturated oils?
Yes.
Not all of them.
Not all. The majority is with vegetable oils. That's polyunsaturated.
Not you don't know that though. The confusing thing about
solid oil we get is
like when you're not at Holden, when you go to the grocery store and you go to buy, you know, you have your choice of Crisco vegetable oil, sunlight sunflower oil, whatever the different kinds are. Vegetable oil, you don't know what vegetables were used to make it. If it was sunflower seeds, you know, if it comes from sunflower seeds, you're in good shape. But it could have come from coconuts. In coconuts, the ratio of polyunsaturated to saturated is like 1 to 185. So one part polyunsaturated to 185 parts saturated. Coconut oil is also the cheapest oil that you can buy. So chances are, in most vegetable oils, it's going to make up a large percentage of the oil. So that's why it's important to buy something that says safflower oil, 100% safflower, 100% sunflower oil.
Corn oil
is like, if it says 100% corn oil, then that's good. That's fine. You know, and there's probably some corn oil and vegetable oil, but they just don't tell you how much. And it's a confusing thing on a lot of labels now that says it may have soybean oil, coconut oil, or corn oil. You know, it says or in there, not and. You know, so chances are you don't know which of those three oils are in it. And coconut oil is not good.
That's usually the top
one. Yeah.
Okay. I know one brand we get is soybean. I don't recall what the other one is. Something to look at.
Corn oil is always more expensive for safflower oil, but I sure think it's worth getting if you do much cooking. They can.
What is a good old regular recipe that, you know, as opposed to like Crisco or Wesson?
Well, I don't mix shortenings and oils, but if a recipe calls for oils,
Safflower oil has the least flavor of any oil that you can cook with. So it'll taste like more like lemon or more like chocolate or whatever you want it to flavor, because safflower oil doesn't have a flavor of its own.
Sunflower oil really tastes bad. Yeah. You can really taste, I mean, it's not bad taste, but you really know when you use sunflower oil.
Well, something that, like when we make, in recipes, we used to make pancake batter or cornbread, it says to melt lard and put it in, but we just add the regular liquid oil and it makes no difference in the recipe. So you can substitute liquid oil a lot for the Crisco type stuff.
How many eggs are we supposed to eat a week if the yolk and all of this is a big problem? What are they saying? I've heard that it's a problem, then I read it wasn't such a problem. Do you know?
I think I've heard No more than 3 a week per person.
I've heard 3 or 4 eggs a week.
We get more than that here. If you count pancakes, French toast,
not
egg
necessarily. The worst is if we have scrambled eggs or something like that. Egg cock is not bad. Because, see, what, times 1 is 50?
15.
15. Eggs. We're now only doing times 2, so that's 30 eggs for 70 people. Mm-hmm. So you're not getting much eggs in that. Pancakes is even less than that.
Muffins are done.
So as far as those things go, no, you don't get a lot. If you're having a fried egg or scrambled egg, you're usually getting like 1.5 eggs or 2 eggs to that.
And did you say also that carbohydrates form cholesterol? Is that what you said?
Carbohydrates and sugars also will stimulate your body to produce more cholesterol. So it's not only fats that you consume that do it. It's directly tied to your sugar consumption too, which greatly affects your heart disease rates too. Another thing I wanted to look at was hydrogenated fats. Our industrialized society has taken a lot of unsaturated fats, such as peanut butter, or like our shortening, and hydrogenated them, which means that they've added the hydrogens to the empty arms on the carbon chain, and they become saturated fats.
That's what makes what Jif creamy.
That's why
creamy.
They stay creamy and solid at room temperature. They don't get the oil on top. Holden doesn't use that kind of peanut butter.
And you really have to look out for those labels that say partially hydrogenated. That really lets you know that they've pumped back the hydrogens back in. The reason for putting the hydrogen is to keep the acid from turning rancid. I mean the fat from turning rancid. So it has a longer shelf life and it's creamier, it's more appealing. But a grocery store brand that you can buy is Laura Scudder's.
Yeah.
That's
is what?
Laura Scudder's peanut butter.
California.
Oh, they don't have it everywhere?
Another kind isn't Adams peanut butter.
Well, if you buy a peanut butter that has like a half an inch of oil on top,
that does.
Then it's good peanut butter. Just stir it up, and then you have to keep it in the refrigerator. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, if you keep it out, it will turn rancid.
Right. It'll and that's what it says on it. Adam's peanut butter said, you know, keep refrigerated on it.
Okay.
And I think that's probably...
But if you buy peanut butter with oil on top, then you have a good peanut butter.
That might be in Washington or something where it's sold. I don't know. Or West Coast.
Shirley, what's the relationship, once more, between saturated fats and cholesterol?
Saturated fats will stimulate your body to produce more cholesterol and
so
raise your blood cholesterol.
Your skinny peanut butter could have no cholesterol, but it's bad because it stimulates excessive cholesterol production in your body.
Does anything have just cholesterol in it? I thought
eggs do.
Eggs.
That's about ice cream, dairy products, animal fat.
Oh, that's right.
This is sort of a silly question. If you pack a lunch, or if you're a parent and you pack lunches for your kids to take to school and you buy the natural peanut butter that's not highly needed, you send them on the bus at 7 in the morning with peanut butter and jelly sandwich, because that's what they like, and by 12:30 when they have their lunch break, is that going to...
It's fine.
No, it's fine.
Once you stir it up, if you let it sit out, it will separate again, but once it's on a sandwich, that's all kind of peanut butter I've ever had, and nothing's ever happened.
Lunches and hikes, you know. Oh, you don't?
No, it's fine on the sandwich.
That's
you can't tell the difference.
In fact, once you get used to it, go back to the old hydrogenated
peanut butter with sugar and salt added to it. It just tastes repulsive. You lose the total peanut taste.
But your sandwich is fine.
Yeah.
My mother's been interested in nutrition for a lot of years, and she's also a dairy farmer's wife. So she's she's always reading articles and sending away for information on cholesterol and animal fat's role in cholesterol as a problem. And she has found by her selective reading and research, a lot of research that supports the use of animal fats over against vegetable oils, and that is very well documented. Research in the farming communities where people work very hard and also have a higher than average intake of animal fats, and there's no cholesterol problem. The fact that women before menopause usually don't have any kind of cholesterol problem. Estrogen, and that takes care of it until after midlife crisis.
But once they reach that, then the levels just shoot right up.
Well, she has high blood pressure herself, so she has tried experimenting on herself. And she has tried, like, almost totally eliminating sugar, but continuing to eat eggs and butter. And her cholesterol dropped way down. She could go off medication. And then she told the doctor what she had done. I think it's dangerous to say polyunsaturated are the good guys.
Mm-hmm.
Leo Husted, who's been up here and has done cancer research, says that he thinks the one thing that's really wrong about Holden's diet is the amount of hydrogenated vegetable oils in our diet, and that we should not use margarine, we should use very minimal amounts of butter. So you can find evidence both ways, and I just think it's really dangerous, like the commercials blab at us that we should eat margarine and things like that. And the health problems are still there. It's not like heart disease has disappeared.
Get back to your quilt,
man. I'd like to add something to what Marilyn said, because in Spokane's very well known for their heart cardiovascular units. They do a lot of open heart surgeries and stuff there. And the doctors from Spokane, they put out a Sunday paper called You Magazine, and they've written articles about the cholesterol, and they said the same thing as Marilyn did, that studies have shown that the butter and the creams that people are saying you should not have are a lot of times a lot better for you, because the margarines have a lot of vegetable oils that are higher in the saturated fat than the actual butter and the creams themselves. So
yeah,
there's give or take in both.
A nurse in Spokane told me that what they use to solidify margarine is either what they use in the process, it's better to eat butter. So apparently maybe the softer margarine in the tub is better than buying the
cubes.
Yeah, the cubes. And I agree with Marilyn, because look at Norway. Look at the way they eat.
Well, Denmark, too. The latest studies at Eschenhofer, Denmark, which is a very high dairy producing and consuming country. They're one of the lowest in cholesterol.
Is, like Cheryl had said about salt, it is a very hereditary and genetic thing that determines how you deal with your cholesterol problems. Some people, it doesn't affect them at all. But in our country, there are a lot of people who it's gotten to be a hereditary strain, that a lot of people are very susceptible and weak to cholesterol levels already. And it's also part of our lifestyle, our diets, how much different. We get a lot of commercially processed foods that have things in it that we don't realize have in it. A lot of extra fat here and there added. And just closing comments, I wanted to share from this book a few ways that are relatively painless to cut down your fat intake.
What's the book?
It's called Nutrition Scoreboard. It's in the library.
fiber here. A few ways are like drinking skim milk or 2% milk instead of whole milk or buttermilk. Eating beans, grains, and cottage cheese instead of meat. Not eating hot dogs or bologna. Fat in those provides 80% of their calories. Cutting off as much excess fat as possible from meat before and after you cook it. Eating a different grade of meat. The choice and prime grade meat are high in fat, and good grade cuts are low in fat, cheaper and perfectly acceptable in stews and casseroles, etc. And then, a few ways you can increase the amount of polyunsaturated fats in your diet and reduce the amount of saturated fat is using margarines that contain liquid oil instead of regular margarine, just like you guys were talking about.
Promise is a good one.
Pardon?
Promise is a good one.
Using cream in your coffee or tea. Avoid using coffee whiteners because they usually contain coconut oil or palm oil or hydrogenated oil. Eating less meat and cutting off the fat from the meat you do eat. Fish is a good source of unsaturated fat. And eating fruit for dessert instead of ice cream.
What is the creamer that we have at Whole Foods?
I think it's coconut oil based.
It doesn't even all dissolve. I mean, it even looks kind of.
I think it depends how old it is.
Curdle. Yeah.
I think that stuff has been around a long time.
Bad
for
you. I feel like an unfaithful son.
Oh, you mean, okay. The stuff in the jar is Primora?
No.
That's the coconut oil. The stuff in the little
silver
pitcher?
Yeah.
That is just non-fat milk crystals. It's not even cream. It should dissolve. Yeah,
oh.
Powdered milk is what it is.
Just hard to dissolve, yeah. Oh.
I guess. I think if it sits outside, it gets moisture. And then it's harder to dissolve than when we just open the package. I think that's what happens to the little thing that sits out there.
Okay.
But
does anyone know what's bad about ice cream? Somebody says it has something like
she'll get to that.
No, I have a comment on that. I've seen a list that says ice cream has an ingredient in it that's also in antifreeze. And it goes through this whole, you know. And sure, you know, you could, I don't know what ingredient, it doesn't say, but they both have
water.
Water. it's just a ridiculous list. It's really a scare thing. It's crazy. It doesn't tell you what any of the things are, it just makes all these parallels like that.
I'm going to talk about protein. So protein is something that's been misunderstood by many people. There's been and still is a paranoia about not getting enough protein. Most Americans consume nearly twice the amount of protein they need. What is protein? This is a dictionary definition of protein. Any of a great class of chemicals that contain carbon, hydrogen, nitrogen, oxygen, and sometimes other elements, meaning phosphorus or sulfur. Are the other two common elements that they're talking about there. They are present in all living matter and are an essential food item. That's the definition. Now, protein is made up of 22 different amino acids. All but 8 of these 22 can be made by the body. So it is these 8 that must be present in the food that we eat. These are known as the essential amino acids. how does our bodies use protein? Our bodies are approximately 20% protein by weight. Protein makes up our skin, hair, nails, cartilage, tendons, muscles, etc. Hormones such as insulin and enzymes are also protein. As you can see, protein is a very necessary item. The general minimum requirement of protein is 47 grams for women and 57 grams of protein for men per day. Protein is not stored in the body and must be replaced every day. That's why if you're going to be a vegetarian, you should research the sources of protein of the non-animal sources. Okay, different sources of protein are, let's see. Well, in order to have a complete protein, you must have all 8 essential amino acids present simultaneously and in the right proportions. Meat, along with the egg, has been the most commonly thought of source for protein because they contain all the necessary amino acids. It's simple to get your protein, I think. The quality of protein, however, is no different than that from plant sources. The thing that counts is the essential amino acids be present. This is where protein complementing comes in. A more accurate description would be to call it amino acid complementing. Examples of complementing combinations. Anytime you have milk plus a grain, which would be wheat, rice, barley, millet, that's, you can get all the amino acids that you need. Milk plus nuts and seeds, milk plus legumes, which are beans and peas and peanuts, milk plus potatoes. Same time you get like au gratin potatoes or cream potatoes, that's a complete protein. Legumes plus rice, legumes plus wheat, legumes plus corn, and eggs and grain. Like a few eggs can complete a large amount of rice into a higher level of protein intake. Different meals, like the other night we had lentil stew. If you just ate lentil stew by itself, it is not a complete protein. But if you have lentil stew and the piece of bread that is served with the meal, you have a complete protein. So, and one of the highest, I just thought this is interesting, we get a lot of flack for cod night. And one of the highest sources of pure protein without calories is cod. Haddock and cod are the two highest proteins with the least amount of calories to get it. So that's all I have to say. They're low in fats. There's no fats. That's why it's so low in calories.
You want to ask that? Food additives are something that has become a big topic in the last couple of years, and all of us are concerned, or a lot of us are concerned, about what's added to our food to make it look better or taste better that doesn't really add any nutritional value. Some of these that we're familiar with is MSG, or monosodium glutamate, and there's tons of them, a lot of them I can't pronounce, but there's food additive and food ingredient is two things that need to be differentiated. A food ingredient is something that's natural and occurs in nature, like sugar. A food additive is something that's synthetic. It's made to enhance the flavor, improves color, extends shelf life. An example of that would be saffron. On some foods, besides food ingredients, food additives, another thing that often in food that we don't know about is something called a contaminant, and that is what's left over from a pesticide that's put on the foods, and that's not all gotten rid of before it's marketed. That's not usually done on purpose, but you know, that's something. And then another thing that sometimes is in food is something called an adulterant. And that's added just to deceive the consumer. Like caramel coloring may be added to bread to make it look brown, like it has more whole wheat flour in it, whereas actually it doesn't. That's what that means. Lots of times I've heard people say, you know, when you read the labels of food, you know, and it has all these fancy sounding names, that they're like, oh, those are all additives, we can't eat them. And food additives are chemically combined, chemicals, but all food is chemicals. Digestion that takes place in our body is a chemical reaction. Food spoilage is a chemical reaction. So it's not fair to say that that food additives are chemicals and therefore we shouldn't eat them. That all the stuff that's around us is additives or are chemicals. Many of the food additives, a big problem with food additives is that they haven't been adequately tested. They're not. It's not known whether they're safe or not. Until 1960, the FDA had no means or no law that said that for testing food additives. Until that time, up until 1960, FDA had to prove that a substance was bad. Now, in the past 20 years, if a new additive comes on the market, the company or the manufacturer has to prove to FDA that it's safe. So much more research goes into it, but it's from the manufacturer's viewpoint. So since 1960, before 1960, all of the ingredients or all the additives that were used were put on a list that's called a generally recommended as safe list. On that list are things like saccharin, cyclamates, salt, vinegar, spices, just everything. There's like 800 some items. Some of those items have been tested, but not all of them. It's a pretty time-consuming process. And so a food that's on this list doesn't necessarily mean that it's safe, and that's kind of sometimes is confusing. I wanted to take about three additives that are biggies and just talk a little bit about them so that we understand them. One of them is sodium nitrite, which is as a substance that when it comes into our body is converted to nitrite. And this is something that's added mostly to cured meats, like pork. There's two reasons why nitrites are used. One of them is that nitrites prevent the growth of the Clostridium botulinum, which is the causative organism in botulism. And the second reason is that nitrite react with the myoglobin in meat. Myoglobin is what makes meat look grayish, but when you have nitrite in it, it reacts and it makes it look healthy red. So that's on, you know, things like frankfurters, hot dogs, and sausage and stuff. With nitrites added, it has a nice red look that we've come to think means healthy. Myoglobin, if it doesn't combine with nitrate in the body, it stores oxygen, and it also provides oxygen to the skeletal muscles. So it's a good thing to have around. And then nitrite can react in human digestive tract with secondary amines to form something called a nitroso compound, which can lead to cancer in test animals. All of the research that I read on food additives say that it can and it has led to cancer in test animals. And you have to interpret that to mean what you want it to. I always rationalize when there's something that I like sassafras, that is said to be carcinogenic, that it's not going to cause cancer in me. I like it. I'm going to drink it. You know, so that's up to individual discretion. One of the biggest problems I think about nitrites is that because of the way it not only does it combine with what's called myoglobin, it combines with hemoglobin in our blood, which is what carries our oxygen. Now, for adults, this is generally not a real problem because most of us have enough hemoglobin, and the small amount that combines with the nitrite isn't a real problem. But for babies, it is during the first year of life. And nitrites used to be found in baby foods, but since all the stuff has come out about them, that they're banned. So it's important, you know, to remember if you have a child or if you're around children, it wouldn't be good for a baby under 1 year old or anywhere around that age to be eating stuff like hot dogs or or foods that you know that contain nitrites. It didn't say what it cost. I assume that because that babies have a lesser amount of hemoglobin, that if more of the nitrate combines with the bilirubin, with the hemoglobin, then there's a lesser amount of oxygen carried to the rest of the body, which the same thing happens to us, but we just happen to have a lot more blood or a lot more hemoglobin. The thing that you were asking, Bev, about the ice cream, a big substance in ice cream, not in something, not a natural ice cream. I was going to say Breyers, but probably most of you haven't heard of Breyers. There's a substance in it called carrageenan, and it's a thickener. In the same family with carrageenan is stuff like algin and agar, which all come from seaweed. So it is a natural substance, but if you want to think of it, you can think of it as seaweed. And they're all in the family of gums. And the purpose of a gum is to thicken food and to give it mouth feel. That sounds kind of strange, but like a diet drink that's sweetened with saccharin or whatever they use to sweeten it with has an empty kind of feeling. And so they now put gums in diet drinks because they have more, makes them have more body, and it feels like that you're getting the real thing, even though you're not.
Are those bad for you?
On the list that I had, the book that I had, they're listed as safe. If you've ever let a half-gallon carton of ice cream melt, of the stuff that's not natural, if you come back in a couple hours or however long it takes to melt, you'll have all this stuff leaking out of the bottom of your carton, and then in the middle you'll have a nice big glob that doesn't melt, that doesn't do anything, it just sits there. That's the carrageenan mostly. I don't know that it's really that bad for you, it just doesn't sound so great. And like the ice cream that we have here, it's not that good ice cream as ice cream goes.
Carnation.
They add things too.
Are there ice creams like Breyers on the West Coast? I'm sure there are.
Sure.
Haagen-Dazs. Yeah, that's much more expensive than Breyers.
Who you pay?
Breyers is fairly reasonable on the East Coast, Baltimore.
Yeah. There's also a Dreyer's, D-R-E-Y-E-R, ice cream on the West Coast. And that was about half again more expensive than most ice creams, but it was most
good.
Advertised as natural.
It's good stuff.
Can I say a word about that? The word natural, it doesn't mean a hoot.
I'm not talking about it.
I was just. any food processor or manufacturer is now permitted to use the word natural in any way, shape, or form that they want on the label. They can say natural dog food, natural corn chips, natural anything you want. They still have to list what's in it, but the word doesn't mean anything anymore.
It's a catchword.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a
cliche. Like organically grown.
Right, in the dirt.
Yeah.
Natural potato chips.
A lot of those that were used, pesticides, like in the Consumer Reports magazine that you gave me, listed some kind of health foods, I forget what they were, and it gave the amounts of, how they always categorize everything or rate it, they gave the amounts of insect and rat hair and particles that were found in them. And they said that's the problem with organically grown things. You get a lot more insects, and the federal government allows so many insect legs and N or whatever per whatever it is.
let's just all go to the dining hall and eat.
Flour, the number of rats that die and get in flour,
you're allowed so many, like 12%
cool.
droppings
well, and rat hairs.
While we were talking about that, I looked up in this book about those that you asked. Carrageenan is listed as, its function is a thickener, and it said here that it's safe for adults and questionable for babies. It's not, the source is not given. If anyone's interested in looking up a particular thing, it's a nice chart, and it lists things as safe, unknown, or questionable. Like that.
When you were reading about nitrites, did you read, come across, you were talking about nitrous amines?
No.
I read an article about nitrous amines, and it talked about it, that it was all used in the same way that you described nitrites in meats, used to as a preservative and to keep the color and everything. So I'm not sure how different they are, but the article was talking about beer, and that there are a lot of beers. They mentioned a certain type of beer, I don't know, Coors, or a can of Coors has as much nitrous amines as a pound of bacon. And there were some real bad beers, and I think Coors was one of them. And there were some beers that had very low levels of nitrous amines. Any beer that has to be refrigerated from the time it's made to the time you buy it, it would be one that...
That used to be true, of course. I don't know if it's still true.
Yeah. You want to speak to that grammar from Denver?
Just a couple things I think it's important to remember, like near where we live in West Virginia, it's part of the Goiterville, and we have some neighbors who don't use salt, and with iodized salt, and if you don't eat a lot of fish, and I think iodine is in spinach, isn't it? There are a couple of food sources that are good sources of iodine, but to cut out salt, I mean, I don't know how much salt you have, and you should buy iodized salt to make sure that you get enough iodine so you don't have hyperthyroidism, which we see in around West Virginia quite a bit.
On the West Coast, that's not a problem because of all the seafood.
I wanted to make a comment about the ice cream too, Jim, not to spoil your trip or anything, but I was reading at your house one night, Eric brought out a about a Consumer Report kind of for kids on milkshakes.
They're not.
And
McDonald's doesn't call them milkshakes, they're shakes.
Yeah, most of them are not. They're shakes because they add Jell-O to their stuff, so when it comes out really thick, it's because a lot of times the Jell-O has been added. Most of the places nowadays don't have a mixer there where they put it in and it will mix it all up and everything. Instead, it just pours right out and it's all thick. And they did it like a study, and they had like Burger King, Wendy's, McDonald's. There were like four or five chains. I can't remember what the other ones were. And Wendy's, when they left it out, like overnight, 24 hours, and they went back and looked at it, and it was still real thick. And it didn't solidify at all. And it had this little crust on the top of it and stuff. And the same thing with Burger King.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah.
And then
did you have
McDonald's was the best. It had solidified quite a bit compared to everything else, but it still kind of was like half and half, and you know the other ones too. So when you know the best place to really get a shake is if you go to a parlor and you see them really shaking it up, you know, blending it up.
I don't understand the solidifying stuff. What
well,
is that?
I mean, the Jello in it, it's just clear gelatin or whatever that they add to the somewhat of the ice cream. So when the gel then doesn't melt, it just stays there. So you know, most of it is not ice cream.
I mean, gelatin is fine.
No,
yeah,
it's just not what it says.
But it's not what it says. Well,
I mean,
they
don't say
that.
It's
kind of disappointing.
It's a assumption.
Yeah, and that's why, you know, the thicker they are, the more gelatin they have in it.
I'm never eat again.
Thank you.
Oh, yeah.
I'm not letting you.